into the calculability, I guess. So it's a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank the organizers for the invitation. And this is work in collaboration with Emilian Dudash and Tony Gergetta, came out last December. And what I'd like to do is talk about how one might go about producing a toy model of the landscape, which hopefully is calculable in certain ways so that one can really try to extract some feeling for how probabilities might scale and how they might behave and what things look like. So there's a lot of work here, and it's basically all in field theory. So these are field theory models, not string theory. But at the very end, for a few minutes, I will talk about some calculable, some calculations that have been done in actual string models as well. So this will really be field theory. So let me first just remind everyone that recent developments, and we've heard a lot just very recently, last talk, in the study of string theory landscapes, suggest the existence of huge numbers of string vacua. These are the landscapes. And they each have different low energy phenomenologies. And they have different Susie breaking scales, gauge groups, particle contents, cosmological constants, all the interesting physics that we care about. And so there are many ways that people have proposed to deal with this situation, perhaps using a vacuum selection principle or some statistical approach or anthropic arguments even. But the main difficulty is that it's difficult to survey the landscape completely. It's a highly non-trivial string construction usually that has to go into building these models, flux compactifications, many variables, many constraints. And it's not really clear how to do explicit calculations. And so our approach here will be to examine explicit field theory counterparts of such constructions. These will be field theory models which naturally give rise to large numbers of vacua. And by having a field theory model, relatively simple, we'll then be able to explicitly calculate physical properties such as the scale of Susie breaking or the presence or absence of R symmetries and the stability of the vacua, the extrema that we have. So our field theory models that we're going to look at are basically Susie models, supersymmetric n equal 1. And they'll have multiple abelian gauge groups and multiple charged scalar fields. And these are very straightforward to analyze explicitly. And they have a rich vacuum structure, as we'll see. And in some sense, they're not just toy models. We believe they really are actual components of the full string landscape, because string models typically have large numbers of U1 gauge fields. So these are some component. What we're showing here are field theoretic components of this full string landscape in terms of its phenomenology. And in some sense, and as if I have time, I'll get to it, we can actually view these as deconstructions of actual flux compactifications. So these, what we're doing here, even though these are, strictly speaking, field-theoretic analyses of vacuum structures, should really be directly relevant to studies of the full string landscape. So just to get going, not even a toy model, a pre-toy model, let's just remember the Fayet-Iliopoulos model of Susie breaking. So this has one U1 gauge group with a gauge coupling G, a Fayet-Iliopoulos D term with a coefficient C, two charged chiral superfields, plus and minus charges, and a superpotential, which depends on the mass parameter there. And then what do? We just extremize the scale of potential. We classify the resulting vacua, for example, in terms of the VEVs, plus or minus, for the two different fields. And there are a variety of possible VEVs that could come out, possible vacuum classes. One class has no VEVs. One class has a VEV for the first one, but not the second. And the second one has a VEV for the second and not the first. So I'll always indicate a notation here where I indicate which VEVs are non-zero. So this zero means the empty set, no VEVs at all. They're all zero. And so you easily find standard analysis that the no VEV solution exists for all values of the Fayet-Iliopoulos coefficient, but it's stable only if this condition is met. These are vacua where the U1 is unbroken and the R symmetry is preserved. The others exist in various other cases. They're always stable whenever they exist. And in these, the U1 and the R symmetry are broken. So these are standard results. But let me think about this as a kind of landscape. So I would consider the C as a parameter defining the model. So as a function of C, I could plot the vacuum structure of the Fayet-Iliopoulos model. So here's C, and for certain values, I have the vacuum being in the minus category. In these other cases, I have the vacuum in the plus category. In the middle case, I have the null category. The null category exists everywhere, but it's unstable. So wherever the vacuum exists, but it's unstable, I'll indicate it in tiny little print. So these are unstable extrema of the potential. The shaded regions here, shading is always going to indicate potential R symmetry breaking. So R symmetry is broken here and here in this little landscape. And each point on this line corresponds to a different value of C, a different theory with a different unique vacuum. So this is, in some sense, a field theory landscape for the Fayet-Iliopoulos model. And when I talk about landscapes, I'm going to mean it in this sense. Of course, you could really say, well, the mass is also a parameter defining the model. So really, I should think of this landscape as being two-dimensional, where I have the C and then the mass. And then what happens is I have these lines with slopes that are 1 over g squared. Again, in this region, in these shaded regions, I've broken R symmetry potentially, meaning that my F terms are going to be non-zero, have non-zero VEVs. And the slopes here are 1 over g squared, and the unstable extrema in each region are given by this. And so this looks like a two-dimensional landscape. And then I could say, well, even g, the coupling, can also be considered a landscape parameter. It's really in strength theory related to a VEV of a dilaton, so there's no reason not to consider it that way. And then I would have a three-dimensional landscape coming out of the transparency projector where this slope keeps changing. So that's a kind of trivial landscape. But already you could say, well, let's treat this in landscape language. What would be some probabilities? For example, what would be the probability that R symmetry is preserved? And clearly, this depends on the landscape coordinates and the integration measures that we choose. For example, in the one-dimensional landscape, where it was just R symmetry here and here, the R symmetry preserving region was just in the middle. And so you'd see that if you took your measure, your variable to be C, and your measure just to be integrated over that line, you see that the probability of preserving R symmetry is basically zero because of the infinite weighting given to these regions where C is relatively large. In the two-dimensional landscape, we have this picture, and you want to know the probability of being in this region that isn't shaded, well, then if you took a measure like this, the probability it's the angular fraction, it's just some number that depends on the coupling. In the three-dimensional landscape, well, again, it depends on how you choose the measure. If you choose a measure that just integrates over all couplings, again, the large g would dominate where this is closed, and you would have no probability, essentially, a set of measures zero, for preserving R symmetry. But maybe you'd say, well, I shouldn't use that measure. I should consider the angle of closure to be the thing. This is the angle of closure, and I would define it from 0 to pi over 2. Use that as my measure. What this does in terms of couplings is it suppresses the large coupling. If I do that, I then get a finite result, which is actually a half. OK, so this is just a kind of game. And you can ask if this is really meaningful. And there are a lot of things I'm glossing over. I should really impose cutoffs for at the Planck scale and for perturbativity. But these kinds of results are still generically OK in a field theory language. This choice of measure is now exposed to be a really critical issue. Ultimately, if this comes from string theory, the underlying landscape parameters will be some sort of VEVs of moduli and fluxes. And these have to be quantized and bounded by various kinds of constraints. So really, in the string language, the measure would be determined somehow in string theory in terms of the fluxes. And then somehow, in terms of the fluxes, we calculate these more phenomenological variables. So the measure in the flux space determines the measure over here in these effective landscapes that I'm talking about. And the third thing to realize is that this mapping between the primordial string variables and the phenomenological landscape measure variables that I'm interested in is generally energy dependent. So these kinds of quantities are subject to renormalization group flow, and therefore the effective landscapes that we're talking about actually evolve as a function of renormalization. The landscape evolves, and as well as our position in the landscape moves around, and we'll discuss this in a few minutes. So the actual toy model I do want to spend the bulk of this talk analyzing is so simple you wouldn't believe it could possibly have an interesting, complicated vacuum structure, but it does. It's just a straightforward generalization where I have n equals 2. U1s. So there are going to be two U1s, and little n just tells me how many U1s I have. Gauge couplings G1 and G2. Two phi A Eliopoulos coefficients. Three chiral superfields. And there they have charges which I'm going to choose to be motivated by deconstruction, because I want to think about this ultimately as having a higher dimensional compactification interpretation. And then a Wilson line superpotential that I can write down. So five variables, G1, G2, C1, C2, and lambda. And I can simplify by saying, well, let's just let the couplings be one for now, and I'll put them back later. So therefore, the model is defined by three parameters, the two phi A coefficients, phi A Laplace coefficients, and the coupling lambda. And the lambda can be restricted to positive values. And this has a very rich vacuum structure. How do I perform these vacuum calculations? It's pretty straightforward. It's the usual thing I would always do. It's a standard D-term and F-term analysis. I calculate the scalar potential, which has D-term and F-term contributions. D-terms here, F-terms there. I extremize the potential. That's how I get my extrema. I look at the extrema stability matrix, the mass matrix. It's the second derivative. In this case, because I have three chiral fields and they're complex conjugates, it's a 6x6 mass matrix. I then calculate the eigenvalues of this thing. It's zero, there'll be a natural zero eigenvalue for each broken U1, that's the Goldstone boson. Then I look at all the other eigenvalues, and I declare this extremum to be a stable vacuum if all of these others are positive. There's a flat direction if one or more are zero, and the vacuum is unstable. The extremum is unstable if any of the eigenvalues is less than zero. And then I can, again, label the classes of vacua according to their non-zero VEVs. So for example, there are single VEV solutions, so that would be 1, 2, or 3. There are double VEV solutions, 1, 2, 1, 3, 2, 3, and so forth. Triple VEV solution would be 1, 2, 3, and the null solution where they're all zero. So there are 8 possible classes of vacua. And so now you can just ask, well, what do we find? You do the analysis again, and it's rather rich. Let's just start with lambda equals 1. So the physics just depends on the 2 phi A Eliopoulos coefficients. So this is a plane in phi A Eliopoulos space, coefficient space right here, sigma 1, sigma C1, C2. So for lambda equals 1, I find that the first vacuum exists everywhere. There's always a solution to the equations, but it's always unstable. Essentially, it's the unbroken case. It's the top of the Mexican half potential. So it's always unstable, but it always exists. The single VEV cases exist in various regions in this plane, but they're stable only within subregions. The two VEV cases and so forth. And these kinds of tables are meaningless to look at. Again, you want to make an actual landscape plot. So here's the plot. So this is what we actually have for lambda equals 1. So here is sigma 1, sigma 2, the plane. And in big boldface type, I've indicated which class of vacuum is the actual vacuum, the ground state in that part of this landscape. In tiny type, I've indicated in green all the unstable extrema that also exist in that region of the landscape. I've shaded always single shading here will indicate those vacua, which are, in this case, the double VEV vacua, that are places where our symmetry in this landscape is potentially broken, non-zero F-term VEVs. And so you see there's a rather complicated structure here. Each of the single VEV, the thing to notice right now is that each of the single VEV regions has an angle, an opening angle of 90 degrees, and then these just sort of fill in the gaps. Each point in this landscape has a unique vacuum energy and a unique vacuum structure. For example, right here, in this little wedge, this little pie slice, the vacuum is the one state. It's the lowest energy and it's stable. And then there are two unstable higher energy minima, extrema, on top of it. So that's how you read the vacuum structure here. So again, you can ask for probabilities here, and you just count an average. So what is the probability that a random extremum is stable? Well, you look at all those extrema, some of them were the big ones, and some of them were the little tiny type ones, the unstable ones. You calculate weighted over the plane, and the average comes out to be some number, 0.36. And already this is a little bit surprising, because you would have expected, naively, it's a 6x6 matrix of eigenvalues. Each one has a plus one, is a half probability of being positive versus negative. So you would have expected randomly that of all the extrema, that you would have only 1/2 to the 6th. Which are of stable type. But in fact, the probability of stable extrema here is significantly higher than we would have expected. There's a correlation between being an extremum and then being stable. You can ask about the probability that the R symmetry is preserved. You get some number, in this case, 75%. And the probability that Susie's broken actually turns out to be zero. There are Susie is unbroken. There are Susie preserving areas. There's a dotted line here, a dotted line here, and a spine line right along there. Along those lines, Susie turns out to be preserved. But these are just sets of measure zero in this larger Susie breaking landscape. So you can, again, ask, well, what happens now when lambda is not equal to 1? How does this picture change when you vary the Yukawa coupling? So here's what happens when we go less than 1. Here's lambda equals 1/2. What happens is that these single VEV regions, which were formerly 90 degrees when lambda equals 1, when lambda goes down, the angle goes down for them. The angle is always 2 times this fundamental angle, which is just the inverse tangent of the Yukawa coupling. These regions shrink in the landscape, and the double VEV regions, which break our parity, our symmetry, grow to fill in the gaps. So you actually see another interesting, somewhat counterintuitive result, that larger probability of breaking R symmetry occurs as lambda goes to 0. And because as lambda goes to 0, the R symmetry breaking, the R symmetry preserving vacua actually become unstable. They're not vacua. They're merely extrema. So this is what happens when lambda goes to 1/2. As lambda goes to 0, all the way down to the limit, the single VEV regions completely disappear, and you just have everything filled in by these gaps, these double VEV regions. So the entire landscape breaks R symmetry. The actual zero limit is special. In that case, you have a flat direction. The whole thing preserves Susie. So we're just taking the lambda goes to zero limit here when we talk about that. When lambda equaled 1, we had those 90-degree regions which just touched. You can look what happens when lambda gets bigger than 1. In that case, the single VEV regions grow, but now they start overlapping. They bang into each other. So down here, the 1 and the 3 regions are now big angles, bigger than 90 degrees, and now there's an overlapping region. So overlapping regions I'm indicating with a double crosshatch, not like the single one we had before. So here we have the overlap region, a new phenomenon, whereas here we still have the double VEV regions which fill in the gaps. So these are R-symmetry breaking. This is still R-symmetry preserving, but it's an overlap region which starts existing when lambda is bigger than 1. In such a region, each point in the landscape has multiple metastable extrema, multiple vacua. So this is, again, sort of like what we see in KKLT and other scenarios, where we have multiple metastable extrema in these regions of the landscape. So we have intra-model metastability within the same model. And then as you get bigger and bigger, all of the regions bang into each other. There's a critical value lambda star here, which is given by some number, beyond which all of the regions, the single VEV regions, have gotten so big that they all have pairwise overlaps. So again, we see now that there's R-symmetry is preserved everywhere once you've gotten past that critical point. So what we have, and then finally, as you go lambda to infinity, the ultimate limit looks like this, where you just have single VEV regions and then their overlaps. No double VEV regions, no R-symmetry breaking. So these are, for example, regions with intramodal metastability. Each model in these regions has 2 stable vacua, one of which is only metastable, and then 2 unstable extrema. So what we have here, putting this all together, is a landscape of landscapes, or a 3-dimensional landscape, really. You start imagining this is lambda equals 0. The single VEV regions have shrunk to nothing along these axes. Then as lambda gets bigger, you start introducing the single VEV regions with increasing angles. When you hit lambda equals 1 at 90 degrees, these first 2 start touching. These still have gaps in between them with the double VEV regions. Then eventually these 2 start overlapping. You have an overlap region, but still here there's a gap. Then as you come around, you start having gaps everywhere and then overlap regions everywhere. So as you increase lambda, you dial across. All this vacuum structure, each with its own very tiny unstable, very tiny printed unstable vacua on top. It's a rather rich structure here, just for a simple model with 2 U1s. So again, you can calculate explicit probabilities. For example, what's the probability that the extremum is stable as a function of lambda? It goes from 2/7 when lambda was 0 all the way up to 1/2 when lambda is going to infinity. There's an explicit result. And again, it's much bigger than you would have naively expected. Now, really, you should integrate over lambda as well. That's the third coordinate here. But again, you face the question, what measure do you use? If you just choose a standard naive measure, you would get p equals 1/2, that saturated region, because that's from the dominance of large lambda. But the previous plot suggests that maybe when you want to integrate over this kind of landscape, since it's the angle that's going from 0 up to 90 degrees, what you really want, up to 90 degrees, what you really want to use is an angular Yukawa variable and use this integration over from 0 to pi over 2. That gives you a natural suppression from the large lambdas, and now you get an explicit result. Again, it seems like a choice until you have more information from the underlying string construction. Likewise, you can calculate the probability that R-symmetry is preserved as a function of the lambda. This is the probability that you have single VEV regions. You work it out, you find results like this, and you end up getting a plot which saturates at 1. Basically, the probability that a vacuum preserves R-symmetry grows and saturates at 1 once you've gotten rid of the double VEV regions. And again, you might want to integrate over lambda to get a complete probability for this 3-dimensional landscape. Using the angular measure, you get some number. Okay. An interesting feature, though, is that there's a renormalization group evolution in this kind of landscape. There can be phase transitions, and we'll see. The landscape coordinates, C1, C2, and lambda, are all renormalized under renormalization group flow. If you think about it, they're all energy dependent, or if I'm thinking about an early universe, they're temperature dependent. And so in principle, the vacuum state can cross a boundary between the regions, either because you as a vacuum, as a model, walk around in the landscape, or because the landscape itself changes under your feet, or both simultaneously. So you need to calculate renormalization group equations for these kinds of parameters. So to do this carefully, I have to put now back in the gauge couplings, and then I can write renormalization group equations for the gauge couplings, for the Yukawa couplings, and for the Faye-Eliopoulos coefficients. And I do this given the particular matter content that I have. The fact that this is a zero here, that the trace of each set of charges for each U1 is zero, means that the Fayette-Eli-Lapolis coefficients don't run. So they're set at tree level. There's no one loop value that's induced in the string theory or in the field theory. And so since these were the coefficients of our location in this two-dimensional landscape, the location of the landscape is fixed. So the landscape itself, your location in it is fixed, but the landscape itself may evolve under your feet. So let's assume some high-scale values for the gauge coupling and the Yukawa coupling. And then it turns out that if the gauge couplings are equal at some high scale, we can just make this assumption, then that means that from the RG equations that they're equal at all scales. That means that we can just rescale the gauge couplings into the Yukawa coupling. So this is now our renormalized Yukawa coupling, this quantity y. And this is the thing that governs which landscape you're in, which snapshot of the landscape we're talking about, this quantity y. And y is a renormalization group varying quantity. So what we've seen already is that in this little toy model, renormalization group flow simply corresponds to moving between different landscape pictures, in other words, that y evolves, while you hold your original location in that landscape fixed. So you can quickly get a renormalization group equation for this quantity y, and if you massage the algebra, it comes out in a very pretty form. This quantity 3 minus 10 over y squared has some original value, and then at any other scale, it has a value which is the same as the original value scaled by the ratio of gauge couplings. Since this is an infrared free theory, this goes to zero in the infrared, which means that no matter what you started with, this quantity 3 over 10 y squared goes to zero. So what that means is that regardless of your original value of y, the theory flows to an infrared fixed point given at this particular value of y, from either above or below. So if you start below, the theory flows upwards through the previous diagrams, and if you start above, the theory flows downwards. But it always evolves towards a universal infrared limit, a fixed landscape. And this means that since we always have a fixed landscape, we lose our sensitivity to at least one UV parameter. And perhaps this is a more general picture, that we lose, under renormalization group flow to low energies, a lot of sensitivity to the high-scale landscape parameters. So in other words, on this plot of landscape, the landscape of landscapes, under renormalization group flow, our location in the landscape doesn't change, but the landscape evolves under our feet. If we start out lower than some value, we flow upwards in landscapes. If we start higher, we flow down. So what that means then is that an interesting fact is that we can actually have a phase transition, because it may occur that a boundary sweeps past you as you're evolving. And you can look at special cases, and I'll just run through this really quickly. If you start above y bar, this infrared fixed point, then your value of y decreases. So this is coming down the top part of the landscapes. The only boundaries in this case are between single VEV regions like 1 and overlap regions like 1 and 3. Since y is decreasing, these regions get larger and these get smaller. I know it's hard to remember all these details, but you keep looking at the pictures and you can see it. Which means that since this region is getting, the overlap regions are getting smaller, you're getting squeezed out of them into these larger regions. So you have a situation where you have a 1 and a 3, for example, an overlap region, with one of them higher than the other, so one of them is only metastable. And then you get squeezed into this other situation where you only have one stable vacuum. So this kind of phase transition, what occurs depends on the initial state. If you started in the lower region, of the lower vacuum of the overlap region, then you just squeeze right across. It turns out it's degenerate. So there's no transition at all. There's nothing really happens. Whereas in the higher case, then you're plopped down into this lower region, this lower VEV, this lower vacuum. And so this metastable state becomes unstable, essentially, is what's happening. And the theory drops discontinuously. So the vacuum energy changes. It's like a first-order phase transition. Clearly, this physics depends on the relative sizes of the metastability timescale for dropping down before the boundary crossing timescale comes along and pushes you. You can also ask what happens if you start below the infrared fixed point and you're moving up. In that case, you have one VEV regions and two VEV regions. These are growing and these are shrinking because y is now increasing. So you wind up being pushed from an overlap region to one of these that isn't. So you get squeezed across. You can show it's always degenerate at the boundary. And so what that means is that these kinds of situations don't change the vacuum energy. They're second order. You know that there's a phase transition because remember, these break R symmetry and these don't. And then finally, if Y is bigger than that critical value, you find a situation where either you have these kinds of boundaries, which are just like these, or you find a situation where you have a one VeV in an overlap region, but now this shrinks, this grows, you go the other way. So you just slide easily into the degenerate bottom state, again, no phase transition. But otherwise, you have these first and second order phase transitions, which are likely to be very relevant for cosmology. Okay, there are lots of extensions of this kind of picture. For example, one thing you could do that would be phenomenologically important is to add soft mass contributions, a soft mass M twiddle. If M twiddle squared is positive, this increases the stability of the vacua. Previously, we just had these. In the case of lambda equals zero, we just had these shaded regions before. Now this opens up a whole new set of stable minima near the origin. So this is the new part of the landscape that opened up because M squared was bigger than zero. Far from the origin, you can see how this reduces to the old landscape. Only when you have regions with non-zero opening angles, those are the only ones that survive out at infinity. And so that's when you reproduce the old results with these three regions. So effectively, as the Faye-Laplace coefficients get big, all this is saying is that the effect of M twiddle, which is just an infrared thing, becomes irrelevant. And likewise, as lambda gets bigger, the same picture stays, only the angles change so that we always reproduce what we had before. Everything I just said is for M squared bigger than zero. If M squared is less than zero, tachyonic, this adds a pressure towards destabilization. For lambda equals zero, the entire landscape, which was formerly flat, becomes unstable. So there's no vacuum anywhere in the landscape. As lambda increases then, what happens is that stable regions start increasing, but they move in from infinity. So they start, these little wedge slices have displaced vertices. They come in from infinity, but there's still, for small lambda, a hole in the middle where there's no unstable vacuum. So this is a case where you have an unstable region completely surrounded by regions of stability. And then finally, when lambda gets larger, all of them come in and overlap, and now you have multiple overlap regions. So all these kinds of features are present in this same model. Well, we can go beyond the toy model. For example, I can have any number n of these U1 factors. Again, I can choose charge assignments motivated by deconstruction. Also motivated by deconstruction, I'll just take Faye-Laplace coefficients for the endpoint U1s only. I can imagine soft scalar masses here as well. I could put in a superpotential just as I did before, but now it would be for n bigger than 2. This would be non-renormalizable. So really, I would expect on dimensional grounds that this lambda, the Yukawa coupling, would be suppressed. And so I'm going to really only consider lambda goes to 0. So now we're just looking at m squared and the, again, the two variables, the Faye-Laplace coefficients. For n U1s, I now have 2 to the n plus 1 classes of vacua, the single VEVs, the null, the single VEVs, the double VEVs, and so forth. And the stability of the resulting vacua depends on whether there are positive eigenvalues or not for this 2n plus 1 cross 2n plus 1 stability matrix. So for example, for n equals 3, you find when lambda is 0, again, 3 regions with a lot of different unstable vacua in different combinations. This region, though, is now SUSY preserving and R symmetry preserving for all lambda. So this is now a SUSY region of an otherwise non-supersymmetric vacuum moduli space. This is actually what we used to call a moduli space. This is flat. And so we now have a situation where we have a moduli space embedded in a landscape, an example of a landscape with both SUSY and non-SUSY regions of the same dimensionality. And again, you can let m squared be bigger than 0. And now you've got new regions of stability inside that previous picture. And believe me, these get pretty complicated. And I'm not going to plot any more of these. But you get the idea. So this kind of thing can lead to a very rich and complex phenomenology, which is really tractable in principle. Let me point out also that these really can be interpreted in higher dimensions as real compactifications. For general n, you get 3 different vacua. This is how they generalize. And for example, these two SUSY breaking vacua, here are the explicit solutions that they have. And you see that other than the endpoint VEVs, there's all these chains in between of these VEVs that are equal. This is a flat profile in some sense, and you can interpret this as a decompactification of a 5D U1 theory on an R4 cross S1 mod Z2, where the radius is given by this n, is related to this n. So this is just a deconstruction of that theory. Other solutions actually correspond to magnetic deconstructed magnetic flux compactifications, just like we've been hearing about. For example, one of these n-1 VeV vacua, 2 through n, it has a solution explicitly that looks like this. There's zero at the endpoints, and then the VeVs actually now rise as a function along the chain. This is a linear profile. And a linear profile for the VeV solution is a smoking gun for a flux interpretation. And to see that, remember that in a 5D theory, on U1 on R4 cross S1 mod Z2, this contains not only a gauge field, but also this extra scalar, this Z2 odd real scalar sigma. You can solve the field equations for sigma, and you actually have a linear profile, as you would expect. So identify R with N, it's the same solution. It's just a deconstructed version of that solution. And to see the flux, well, the flux comes from the fact that it's a linear profile. So if you consider the sigma to be the sixth component of the gauge field, then you would say, well, the dependence of the sixth component on the fifth coordinate is the flux, and there it is, non-zero. Here's the magnetic flux, and here are extra flux contributions localized on the orbifold fixed points. And you can integrate across the whole space, and you find that it vanishes. The magnetic flux in the bulk is canceled by these orbifold fixed point contributions. Let me make some general comments, and then I'll have a final point. General comments are that solutions with many unbroken U1s might seem to be bad phenomenologically, but they actually can, these U1s get broken by mixed gauge anomalies because we have these bifundamental fields. So these can be canceled by Green-Schwarz mechanisms and extra axionic fields, and one can go further in that direction. Should also point that in the supergravity context, there are heavy supergravity moduli fields which can be integrated out. These can be a source of the large soft-breaking terms and Wilson-Wien contributions that I talked about. This can further increase the stability of these vacuum solutions relative to the unstable ones. And then finally, large gravitino mass and large soft masses might provide new ways of balancing the total cosmological constant to achieve a cancellation. Interestingly, the fact that we have high-scale Suzy breaking in such models and large numbers of stable vacua suggests that we have the preconditions anyway for the split Suzy proposal. So now let me conclude with something that really is string theory, but not current string theory. This is, let me call it, just for your recreational purposes, before the coffee break, let me just call this prehistoric landscaping. This is what people might have done, and actually one person, me, did do back in 1990. This was actually part of my doctoral dissertation. So this is what one might consider a landscape way back then. So what would a landscape be in 1990? Well, heterotic strings, weakly coupled, gauge groups were less than 22, modular invariants. We knew the game. And there were huge classes of vacua within there, orbifolds with Wilson lines, Neurane lattices, free world treat fermions, and so forth. And what I actually did in the context of some other work completely, so the motivations were different, but I actually ended up constructing 10 to the 5 vacua, more than that, with high-scale Suzy breaking, Schurk-Schwarz or non-Suzy orbifolds, and making sure that there are no physical tachyons. So in other words, four-dimensional analogs of the D equals 10 SO16 cross SO16 heterotic string, which is non-supersymmetric but tachyon-free. And each model really is distinct. I don't just mean that they're different in terms of their constructions. They really are physically distinct in terms of their different physical spectra. Now, of course, such models are not stable beyond tree level, but nevertheless, we can calculate a one-loop cosmological constant, which will be finite. It's an actual string calculation now. It's a torus amplitude with all the string states, all the infinite towers of string states running in the loop. And I actually ended up calculating this in the landscape here. This was never published, so I had to take this out of my dissertation. So this is the first time I went back to my thesis in 15 years. And here's the plot. It's in the appendix. Here's a histogram of cosmological constant values. It centers around zero. Some are positive, some are negative. And the contributions from the infinite towers of string states are actually significant in determining both the sign and the overall magnitude of the values that are seen. Now, the actual number that I was calculating, we were limited back then by sun workstations and very ancient things, and the total number of models looked at was 123,000, but still, the closest it ever happened to land to zero was 0.01. So you might ask, why wasn't there anything even smaller? How come we didn't get closer to zero? And the interesting thing that was stopping me then, and which is perhaps relevant now, is that there was a huge cosmological constant redundancy. as I looked at more and more models, the number of different values of the cosmological constant that I got grew, but not linearly. Each new model did not lead to a new cosmological constant value. Here, by 50,000 models looked at, I had 2,000 values of the cosmological constant. By 100,000 models, I only had about a little more than 3,000. More models did not lead to more values of the cosmological constant. This is ultimately because of a consequence of the tight string consistency constraints, modular invariance on the towers of string states, and so forth. But this was a generic feature. Many different string models with entirely different phenomenologies, different gauge groups, matter content, hidden sectors, everything, had identical values of the cosmological constant because there were, in other words, there existed, well, either steps or flat directions. They're discontinuous, but still, flat directions in even in these non-SUSY landscapes. This is ultimately a consequence of the tight string consistency constraints acting on these infinite towers of string states. So it's not just sufficient to ignore the infinite towers and add their contributions as well, even when SUSY is broken. So the natural thing to do is say, well, it looks like it's saturating. How many cosmological constants are there? There's a reason this is only in the appendix of the thesis, but still, I did a quick little fit, and I found that the number saturated about 5,500 with a time scale of about 70,000. So if you had about 70,000 models, you would hit about 5,500 cosmological constants, and that seemed to be the saturation point. Okay, clearly, I said this is just for fun. These models are not stable. They represent only a small, limited class of heterotic strings. But they may hold an important lesson, a moral lesson anyway, for the final string landscape and the kind of architecture that it has. So thank you very much.
Questions? Cillian?
Well, one loop, the one loop amplitude was like, exactly. You know why? Because there was an Atkin-Lehner symmetry acting between the different partition, different models had different partition functions, different numbers of bosonic and fermionic states, different numbers of bosonic minus fermion states. They weren't even that number wasn't the same. But yet, because of an Atkin-Lehner symmetry, these were equal. These are the kinds of stringy miracles that get ignored if you just look sometimes at supergravity alone. Yeah. What in this? Well, I was looking back then. I was looking in the free fermionic construction.